let's begin with something about your background, your family, and your early life and education.
Well, I was born at Hartford, Wisconsin in 1910, but we moved to Milwaukee, I guess I was about 10 years old, at least it was when I was in the fourth grade. I'm not quite sure just why we moved. I think it was because my father, who had been working for the Kissel Car Company in Hartford, lost his job and thought that he'd have a better chance as a painter and decorator in Milwaukee. At any rate, we moved to Milwaukee. My elementary school days were spent in two different schools there. And in 1924, I started at North Division High School. No member of my mother's family or my father's family ever had gone to college. And I had no intention to do so when I started high school. I began in what was then called a commercial course. Courses in commercial arithmetic and a non-academic type subjects, generally.
What had you thought that would lead to?
I guess it just would lead to a job in a store or in an office, something like that. But at least I did not take algebra, geometry, sciences, any of the straight academic subjects. In my junior year, I became very active in the High Y Club of North Division High School, and with the encouragement of the YMCA High Y director, a man by the name of Laurie Applin, I then began to take some of the stronger academic subjects to get ready for college, because Mr. Applin thought that I should begin to think about that. So I started taking those subjects, and in 1928, when I graduated, I had at least the right subjects to get into college, although I didn't have the money at that time because my family was not very well to do. So I stayed out of school a year and worked.
What did you do?
Well, it was an interesting year because I started out as a stock boy in a shoe store on Wisconsin Avenue, or Grand Avenue as it was called then.
This is in Milwaukee.
This was in Milwaukee. Then, through Mr. Applin, I was hired at the downtown YMCA as the desk clerk in the boys' department of the YMCA. And I worked there for 4 or 5 months until spring of 1929, when I was able to get a job as a rodman in the city engineer's office.
What's a rodman?
Well, a rodman is the person who holds an upright bar so that the men that run the levels and the transits can see the right figures on that. It's a beginning surveying type job.
Oh, so this is out in the field.
This is out in the field. It's field work. It's also a job that requires a lot of pounding of stakes. So I learned how to pound stakes into hard ground. And in fact, I was working on several interesting projects. One, the water lines for North Milwaukee, and even more interesting, the 35th Street Viaduct, which was being built at the time in Milwaukee across the valley. It was a dirty job, but I enjoyed it, and it was a good experience, especially because I also could keep the job for summer work, and that I did for the summers of 1930 and 1931. Then in 1929, I'd saved some money and I came to Madison as a freshman, planning to be an engineer because of the experience that I had. Dean Millar, who was a freshman engineering dean, convinced me that I shouldn't be an engineer, and I can't remember why he convinced me, but I decided that I wouldn't major in engineering, but instead go into physical education because I'd been interested in athletics. I played football, so that I was registered as a Phi Ed major in my freshman year. That fall, 1929, was the beginning of the Depression with banks closing, And I decided I'd better return to Milwaukee and attend the extension for the next 3 semesters. I stayed at the extension for those next 3 semesters, taking courses that would help me prepare for West Point, because at that time I decided that I needed additional work in English, in mathematics, and in history to prepare for the examinations for admission to West Point. When I failed the physical examination for West Point, that's when I decided to come back out to Madison in the fall of 1931. And that's when I started majoring, I thought, in mathematics, but soon changed over to psychology.
So you stayed here then and finished up?
And then got my degree in 1933. At that time, I came back to Madison and finished my work in 1933, The Depth of the Depression. When I came back,
you graduated in what?
I graduated in psychology. But while I was in Milwaukee, I had decided to attend or try to attend West Point, because I had a good friend who had been several years ahead of me at North Division, encouraging me to do so. So I took courses those next 3 semesters, that is the second semester of my freshman year and the first 2 semesters of the sophomore year. I took courses in English, mathematics, and history, because that's what I was going to be tested on in order to try to get the appointment to West Point. Well, I did get the appointment to West Point, and went down to Fort Sheridan for my physical exam and flunked it cold with a high blood pressure.
Oh, at that age?
Yeah, so I went back and saw Dr. Thrano in Milwaukee and got on a therapy program to try to reduce the blood pressure. Went down a second time to Sheridan, but still couldn't pass the physical examination because of the blood pressure. Well, interestingly enough, after that, I had no trouble with blood pressure, and in fact, for many years, my blood pressure was lower than it should be rather than higher. But that terminated the West Point goal.
Didn't you say the other day, too, that your family was not terribly enthusiastic about that?
Well, no, I don't think so. They really didn't really care. I was an only child, but I was fairly independent, and I could make my own decisions. That's right. But I decided then that I'd have to do something else. Well, here I was a junior, and I still didn't have a major. So I thought, well, with all the mathematics I've taken, I'll major in mathematics. By that time, I was at the calculus level, and when I got into the calculus course, I realized I'd already reached my apex in my mathematics ability. So I shouldn't major in mathematics. Well, with all these shifting around from civil engineering to physical education to West Point to mathematics, I finally ended up in psychology and majored in psychology, and that was my undergraduate major.
I don't see much connection with all that went before. Why did you pick psychology?
I guess it was largely because of Professor Richard Husband, who taught the introductory course in psychology at that time, and who was very helpful and encouraging. In fact, he encouraged me to go on to graduate work immediately. But 1933 was the depth of the Depression, and there was no opportunity at that time to get a teaching assistantship. So I returned to Milwaukee, and for a year took some courses at vocational school. I took a course in typing. I had part-time jobs. And then through Dr. Lon Edgerton of our School of Education, I came back to Madison and worked on a CWA project helping with job analyses. I had taken courses from Lon Edgerton. And I was still interested in the idea of getting into counseling work. That's really, I suppose, why I decided to major in psychology. So I had courses in counseling from Lon Edgerton, had
the kinds of courses that were offered in psychology at that time, and there weren't very many, and tried to get into counseling work in Milwaukee. I became acquainted with the man that headed this kind of work up in the superintendent's office. Rosencrantz, his name was. And through him, in 1934, I was offered a position at Washington High School, which was one of the very good high schools in Milwaukee, as the first boys counselor and as a mathematics teacher. I had had enough mathematics, and back in those days, since this was the beginning of counseling, one had to be a teacher as well. So I taught five sections of algebra and geometry, but my primary job was that of a boys counselor. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a good school. The students were bright and alert. It was just a very worthwhile experience, which I did for 2 years. Well, by that time, Professor Husband had been able to find a teaching assistantship for me. So in 1936, Jeanette, my wife, and I came back to Madison. We'd been married in 1935. So at 36-37 school year, I was a teaching assistant in psychology, teaching five quiz sections, for which we were paid at that time $450 for the whole year. That meant 10 quiz sections that were taught, five each semester, $450. Friends of mine at that time were working in the junior dean's office in Letters and Science in South Hall. At that time, the administrative organization of the college was set up in such a way that the freshmen and sophomores were handled in one part of South Hall by a junior dean, Professor Harry Glicksman, who was also in the English department. And one of my friends, Neil Drought, had been working with Dean Glicksman, but he had finished his PhD at that time, and I was offered the position. I talked to Dean Selry, George Clark Selry, who was then the dean of the college, and he incidentally handled all the juniors and senior problems in the college, and was offered a full-time position to work as the assistant to the junior dean. We were allowed then to carry a full load of graduate studies also. So I worked full-time in the dean's office, but also carried, I think, 9 credits of graduate work from 1937 until 1941.
That sounds rather strenuous.
It was a little strenuous, but you know, we were young at that time and had lots of energy. And it worked out very well. It was a great experience. Harry Glicksman was a marvelous person to work with. He was a good administrator, a fine counselor, an excellent teacher, and just a great boss, really. I enjoyed working for HG very much. In 1941, then, I received the PhD. And Dean Selry invited me to continue in the office as assistant dean and as a lecturer in psychology. So that starting in 1941, I worked with Mr. Glicksman, with freshmen and sophomores in academic problems and academic counseling, but also started teaching one course each semester in psychology. The first semester, it was a course in psychological testing. The second semester was personnel psychology. These were new courses that had never been offered in the department before.
Oh.
So it was a job, I mean, having a full-time job and in the dean's office and also starting up new courses. But it was fun, and I enjoyed the teaching very much, and did so then for 25 years, from 1941 until 1966. That pretty much covers the period up to the completion of the PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, should I go on from there as far as the rest of my work career?
Yes, and we'll come back to the other things we want to talk about.
Well, in 1941, then, I was the assistant dean with the rank of assistant professor. And that first year, 1941-42 year, my salary was $1,900. I think at the time, the dean of the college was making a little over $8,000, as I recall. So salaries were a little meager. But then, we were still recovering from the Depression, too. Mm-hmm. I continued to work in the dean's office. I was promoted to associate professor in 1946, to associate dean in 47, and to full professor in 1960.
And all this time you were
associated? And all this time I was still in the dean's office. Dean Glicksman left the office, I would guess, around 1948, something like that. I'm not sure when, because he continued teaching in the English department after he left the office. And at that time, then, I was put in charge of the academic aspect of the dean's office.
I wonder if we couldn't pause a bit here, and while you tell me something about what your responsibilities in the dean's office really were.
Good. When I started in 1937, as I indicated, the junior dean's office was responsible for freshmen and sophomores, dean's salary for juniors and seniors. Within our part of the office, I handled all freshman problems, and Dean Glicksman handled the sophomore problems. So that any student that came into the office, whether it was for program planning or for academic difficulties, study techniques, career choices, things like that, all the freshmen were referred to me, all the sophomores were seen by Dean Glicksman. Now, any problem involving a woman student, we worked very closely with the Dean of Women's Office. For example, at that time, Susan Davis was the assistant dean in Dean Troxell's office. It was Dean Greeley at that time. And she was just a marvelous counselor. In fact, she taught me most of what I learned about deaning. Helen Kaiser, so that Susan Davis worked with me. Helen Kaiser worked with Mr. Glicksman on sophomore problems, and then Louise Greeley, subsequently Louise Troxell, worked with the juniors and seniors and Dean Celery. It was mostly counseling. I would say that most of my life, I would consider myself a counselor, because we were seeing the students and we saw them for whatever purposes they came in. Sometimes it was outside work that was interfering with their scholastic progress. Sometimes it was poor health, and we had to refer them to the student health department or to Dr. Annette Washburn, who at that time was the student psychiatrist. It was whatever they come in, and pretty much the same thing that's being done in the dean's office at the present time, I would say.
Does any one sort of problem or sets of problems stand out as being more prevalent than others?
Well, primarily I would say it was students who had scholastic difficulties. They had problems and with their study techniques. Back in those days, there were 6 weeks examinations and 6 weeks reports that were turned in. And we used to see all of the students that had low 6 weeks grades. We called them in and went over their difficulties with them, referred them back to their professors, or referred them to a counseling center. It was mostly scholastic difficulties.
Did you find any appreciable difference between problems of freshmen and problems of sophomores?
Not really. There, back in those days, they talked about the sophomore slump.
I remember that.
Remember?
Yes.
That in the sophomore year, students just sort of fell off and lost their academic motivation, and their record deteriorated. I'm not sure that it really was such a slump. I think that some students were coming to college even in those days that didn't belong there, and they just lost interest and subsequently dropped out. But it wasn't any one thing. I think that every generation of students has its own problems. I know that at the present time, Dean Ginsberg points out the difficulty that students are facing in terms of the nuclear outlook and problems that cause concerns. Well, every generation has had concerns. Ours was the Depression. The students in World War II had to worry about the draft and about war. Every group, it seems to me, has something that interferes with their scholastic success, and they just have to face them and live through them. I should have pointed, I failed to mention one experience that I had as a graduate student that should be emphasized because I think it helped a great deal in my subsequent teaching. My major professor was V.A.C. Henman, who was chairman of the department at the time and who taught courses in the psychology of learning and the psychology of individual differences in the measurement of intelligence. He was a great educational psychologist, but was in poor health during most of the period of my graduate studies, from 37 to 41. And often he would call around 9 o'clock in the morning and ask if I could take his lecture at 11 o'clock because he wasn't able to get to it. I used my own notes from his courses, and I knew where he kept his notes in a file. So between the two sets of notes, I substituted for his lectures. And I did this a great deal for that 4-year period. So that by the time I did get my PhD in 1941, I think I had more lecturing experience than almost anybody else ever had, at least in the psychology department. And that was of great value when I taught my own courses, as I think the high school teaching experience that I had was a real value in my subsequent teaching.
And it sounds like it very well might have been, that you weren't coming at it fresh when you had to develop your own courses.
It was helpful. But as I say, trying to use somebody else's notes along, luckily I took very copious notes of my own so that I could pretty much fill in. But it was a good experience.
Did you attend his classes in between times when he was doing the lecturing?
No, I did not. So that I had to ask him each time, well, Dr. Henman, where did you leave off for your last lecture? But it worked out, and we worked out a system that worked very well.
Well, there's a question. You're talking about each generation having its own problems. What were the freshmen and sophomores like during the late 60s when we were having all those protests on the campus?
Well, that's the unhappiest period of my career at Wisconsin.
Well, could you talk about it some?
Well, by that time, I was in charge of the honors program because I took over responsibility for the honors program in 1963. And my office was on the third floor of South Hall, facing the hill itself. So that all of the groups that marched up the hill and the tear gas that flowed over the hill hit South Hall and hit the third floor, and it was a very unhappy experience. I mean, students would come into the building, with their tear just running out of their eyes. We had to get out of the building several times.
Because
of the tear gas, yes. It just wasn't a good time. And it affected the students, it affected the relationships between students and faculty. I'm sure that everybody that was on the campus at the time felt that it was one of the really unhappy periods of our experience.
How did it affect the students in terms of your relationship with them?
Well, I was fortunate in that I, as I said, was in charge of the honors program. And it didn't affect the honor students near as much as it did the other students. Now, it's true that there were some honor students who were among the radicals, but not very many. And most of them were still primarily concerned with being good students. So that we were fortunate in that regard.
I see. Yes, that would have made a difference, I guess.
But, you know, South Hall was firebombed. We lost all of our files in the first floor. Windows were broken. There was a sit-in. We couldn't get into the building for a day or two. So we experienced the same difficulties that everybody else was experiencing.
Sounds like perhaps a little more so than some.
Well, I guess there were some students that didn't like the dean's offices, and it's. But that's inevitable. I mean, when any administrator is trying to administer rules and regulations, you're bound to find some students that object to the decisions that have to be made, and that's what happens. On the other hand, I think that the University of Wisconsin's tradition and reputation is such that most of the students thought that the high academic standards that were being administered by the dean's office were justified and that they agreed with them. Well, let's see, where else? I should say that I was mentioning the administrative procedure under Selry. When Mark Ingram became dean in 1961, he became dean in 1942 and was dean until 1961. In the middle 40s, Dean Ingram felt that it would be a better organizational arrangement if one office handled all student problems. So at that time, he shifted the juniors and seniors over to our office, and we no longer had a junior dean. So that when Dean Glickspan left the office as junior dean, I was made associate dean and was in charge of all four classes, freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors. Dean Ingram still had an executive committee that worked with him to hear appeals of actions taken by our office. But it was primarily a shifting of student problems from the dean's office over to the associate dean's office. And that came, I think, in around 47, 48, 1947, 48, something like that.
And when did you say you became associate dean?
And I became associate dean in 1947, and I think that's when the shift was made.
When all this was taking place.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you find this a better way of handling these matters?
Oh, I think it was much better because we would get acquainted with the students and get to know them as freshmen, and then we had a folder on every student in the college. And we'd get to follow them through for a four-year period, sometimes for more than 4 years.
So there's more continuity.
That's right. And I think that the students felt that since our office was responsible for the academic problems of students, that there was sort of one office that took care of it. There wasn't a shifting between the sophomore and junior years.
Yes, I can see why that, that would be an improvement.
Maybe, well, maybe I should say something now about the honors program, because that was my next responsibility in the dean's office.
And I was on the point of doing just that, asking about it, because you referred to him a minute ago.
Well, a faculty committee had been appointed in 1959 by Dean Ingram to develop a program for gifted or honor students. Andrew Clark of the Geography Department was chairman of that committee, and I represented the Dean's office on the committee along with seven or eight other faculty members. A program was approved by the faculty of the College of Letters and Science and was put into effect in the fall of 1960 for freshmen and sophomores, and in the following year for juniors and seniors. At that time, I was not the chairman of the program. An English professor, Al Whitley, Alvin Whitley, was the chairman of the honors program. In 1963, however, he asked to be released from that responsibility, and I was appointed as chairman of the honors program and kept that assignment until I retired in 1980. In the beginning, the program was very small. We had, I think, a total of 400 and some students to start with in honors. By the time the program had developed in the 70s, it was over 1,300 students and consisted of about 10% of the LNS enrollment. At that time, I think there were a little over 13,000 students in the college, and over 1,300 were in honors. So it's varied from about 9 to 11% of the total LNS enrollment was in the honors program. So it was a very substantial number of students.
Well, will you describe just how the honors program worked?
Yes. Students were admitted to the program. They had to request application. If they ranked in the top 10% of their high school class, they were eligible for admission. Or if they had a strong B-plus record in college, say a 3.25, they could be admitted any time during the 4 years.
Could they, does that include the coming in as a freshman, they could start right out?
They could start in right as a freshman from high school. In fact, we encouraged the students to do so because we thought that was advantageous for the student to begin the honors work as freshmen. The real value of the honors program was the opportunity to elect honors courses. Now, these honors courses were developed by each department, and the department had to determine for itself what it wanted to offer for honors, but generally consisted of two types of courses. Either the courses were enriched courses, that is, they taught the regular material of the course, but just taught a greater amount of it. They embellished the content. But it's still, in general psychology, for example, all they taught was general psychology, but you learn more general psychology than in the regular course. The second kind of honors course were accelerated courses, where students covered more than just one course itself. A good example of it would be in chemistry, where the honors course included not only a year of general chemistry, but also a year of organic chemistry. Of quantitative chemistry, quantitative analysis. So the students really did more chemistry and advanced in chemistry, so they could skip the quantitative analysis course entirely. An even better example was in Spanish and German, where the honors sequence consisted of four courses. Instead of completing four semesters of German, the students who took the honor sequence completed six semesters of German or six semesters of Spanish. So they completed 3 years of foreign language in 2 years.
How was this managed?
Well, they just covered more material. They were able to, these were bright students and they were highly motivated students and they just did more work. They just covered.
Well, they really did work harder. They weren't just getting better grades in the regular courses.
No. They really worked harder and really did a great deal more work. Well, that I think is the real value of the honors program, the opportunity to elect honors courses, because they are more challenging, they're more demanding, but the students get a great deal more out of them. Some students took a lot more honors courses than were required for the honors degree. To earn an honors degree, that is a BA, parenthesis, honors, parenthesis, closed degree, students had to earn a minimum of 40 credits of honors work. I'm not sure what the record is now, but at one time, a student had completed over 100 credits of honors work when he graduated. And when we asked him why he took that much honors work, his comment was that he wanted to get his money's worth. Well,
That sounds like he did.
I think he did. But many students took a great deal more than the 40 minimum credits required for the honors degree.
How does this compare with the total number of credits that an honors student would need for graduation and as opposed to non-honor
students? Well, all students need 120 credits in our college.
Honors would not.
Yes, for a degree.
So a course in honors wouldn't give them any more credits than, say,
no.
The general course?
No.
The same,
but he had to have a third of the work in honors.
Mm-hmm. I see.
But it was the same amount. Students often raise that question about if they took an honors course, did it mean that they would get more credits? No, they didn't get more credits. The credits that they did get were recorded on their official transcript with an H, however, so that a student who took honors chemistry had 5 H listed on the transcript rather than just 5.
Well, this was, I guess, a way of keeping track about the honors credits.
That's right.
He had amassed.
Now, in the honors program, I think one of the things that we stressed more than anything else, and compared to programs in other colleges and universities, was counseling of the honors students.
This is different from the counseling of students in general?
That's right, yeah. We were the advisors for all honors freshmen and sophomores. When I say we, I had an assistant. The assistant I had for the longest period was Dean Barbara Wiley Peterson, who is still working with the honors program. And she was a very devoted colleague, but between us, we saw all the students that would come into the office. We didn't have any breakdown of Barbara seeing the women and I seeing the men, or Barbara seeing freshmen and sophomores and I seeing juniors and seniors. We each sort of developed our own clientele. But we became acquainted with these students during the summer SOAR program. We saw every honors student in the SOAR program.
What was that?
Well, the SOAR program is a summer orientation, advising, and registration program that the university conducts for new freshmen. It's conducted at the present time in Union South for about a 6 or 7 week period, and all new entering freshmen come there for a general orientation and program planning session. Wisconsin students who have their tests administered, their entrance tests and placement tests administered during the spring semester in their high schools, come for only one day. non-resident students who do not have these tests have to spend 2 days during the program.
They
take these tests the first day. The test results then are available for counseling on the second day, and at that time, a tentative program is made out so that when the student leaves the SOAR program, he has a tentative program for the fall semester. And Dean Peterson and I saw all the honors students that came to the SOAR program. So we met them before they even officially registered on the campus.
Well, these would be the freshmen who had already elected honors. There would be others later on.
These are the ones who had applied, who had responded to the invitation to join the honors program. And as freshmen then, we became acquainted with them. They knew that we had an honors office in South Hall, 301 South Hall. They'd stop in as sophomores, juniors, and seniors, and that meant that we really knew them over a four-year period. And I would say that's another one of the real advantages of the honors program, in that they had sort of an academic home in South Hall.
Did this counseling include suggesting courses that might fit in with their interests or their preparation?
It included the same things that was being done in the regular dean's office, yeah. It included program planning, but it included a great deal more than that. I mean, students would help, for example, with planning the honors program, with making suggestions for forms to send out to faculty members to help them develop better honors courses. In fact, there was a listing of suggestions by the students for what should be done in an honors course that we sent out to faculty members in LNS every semester, which I think they found very helpful. Hmm. But it was general counseling for all kinds of purposes. Health problems, work problems, emotional problems. A student had a problem because he fell in love. Sometimes the problem was because he didn't fall in love. And we tried to help in both cases.
Did any of this involve working with their parents?
Not as much as it did previously. Again, here I think we had fewer contacts with the parents of honor students than the other deans in South Hall have with the parents of their students. I think that's a reflection of the maturity of the honor students and their independence and their desire to handle their own problems. So we really did not have many contacts with the parents of honor students.
You did say that it wasn't as much as it used to be. What made a change?
Well, that was my change, because I had changed from being in charge of all the students that were in the college up to the time that I became the dean for the honors program. And that's where the change. So I think it wasn't a change in time, it was a change in my function, really.
Well, when you became dean for the honors program, you then ceased seeing of the rest of
then we had nothing to do with the other students. Then at that time, Dean Blair Matthews and Dean F. Chandler Young were in charge of the other students, along with the assistant deans that worked with them. But then I no longer had any responsibility for the regular dean's office.
Who took that responsibility over when you became honors dean?
Dean Blair Matthews and Dean, at the present time, F. Chandler Young.
I see.
So those are the two that were in charge of the office.
Simultaneously or
successively? No, successively. Because for a while, Dean Young went up in the a chancellor's office working with Chancellor Young in student affairs there. Mm-hmm. But then he came back to South Hall and now is in charge of the office there.
Yes, I was a little confused about his activities.
Yes. Well, he was in South Hall. He went up to Bascom with Chancellor Young, in charge of student affairs, then came back to South Hall and is now the associate dean there.
I see.
It gets a little confusing.
Particularly where you have young and young.
That's right. That is confusing. And then, you know, there was a George Young who was dean of the law school also. Nice. So there were three Dean Youngs at one time. Edwin Young, the dean of our college, Chan Young, the associate dean in our college, and George Young, the dean of law school. So that can be complicated.
Yes, it can be. Well, what's this UW Council on Honors Programs, which you were also chairman of?
Well, the Council on Honors Programs was an attempt to coordinate honors work on the Madison campus. There are four colleges that have honors programs on the Madison campus: Letters and Science, Business, Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, and Ag and Life Sciences. Each of them has a director and also a student honors committee. And the Council on Honors Programs was an attempt to coordinate the work, not to make it a uniform program, because each of the four colleges had its own requirements and its own policies and procedures, but at least to attempt to coordinate the work and occasionally to get together to discuss common problems. The council consisted then of four directors and four students, one from each of the four programs. It was not a group that met, we may have met no more than twice a year, often just once a year. And as I say, was really a coordinating group. Other areas concerning honors that I was involved in, the most important one was the National Collegiate Honors Council. The National Collegiate Honors Council was formulated in the middle 1960s and is still functioning. And it's the official professional organization of honors programs throughout the country. Almost all of the universities and colleges that have honors programs belong to it as organization members, but also faculty members and directors and students even can be individual members. And it's really the most important professional organization for honors programs. I've been active in the group since it was formulated and served both on the executive committee and as vice president and president. In 1979-80, I was the president of the organization.
When was it started?
It was started around 1966-67, something like that. The first meeting I know was at the University of Kansas. Each year it's held in a different city. Last year it was at Omaha, Nebraska. This coming fall it will be at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. It's like a regular professional meeting with seminars, with lectures, with workshops, business meetings, and some fun sessions too.
Well, that's nice. So this tends to make honors programs around the country more unified.
Well, I wouldn't say that it attempts to unify them, but to distribute information about the different programs. There's no attempt to accredit honors programs. Some people have urged that should be done, that to be listed as an honors program, you have to meet certain standards and criteria. Most of us object to that because I think that I was saying that some people have believed that honors program should be accredited, that certain standards and criteria should be established, but most of us believe this would be unwise because an honors program should be formulated based on the traditions and customs of each individual college and university. And that is the situation. On the other hand, we can all learn from what other schools have done, and that's been one of the real values of the organization, that at these workshops, people tell how they handle a particular problem of selecting honors students or of awarding financial grants for the senior honors thesis, things like that. And it's been a very worthwhile organization, and I think one that I've enjoyed a great deal more than my own professional organizations, such as the American Psychological Association or the Midwest Psychological Association.
You said something just a minute ago that interests me, which was financial grants for writing honors senior theses. Did your office have anything like that?
I'm glad you asked, because if there's one thing that I am proud of in terms of my tenure as honors chairman, it's what was done to help honor students get funds for their senior honors thesis. One of the requirements for the honors degree is completion of a research project that results in the senior honors thesis. And for many years, students had no financial help of any kind that they could get to take care of necessary expenses. I talked to faculty members about this, one of whom happened to be Professor Glenn Trewartha of the Geography Department. He's a retired geography professor, a good personal friend and neighbor, and he and his wife, Sarita, decided to begin to set up a fund to help students meet some of their needs concerning the senior thesis requirement. Originally, they gave a $10,000 grant to the UW Foundation with a project that was called the Trewartha Honors Undergraduate Research Fund. We referred to it as TURF. And this was to give students funds to help them with necessary expenses during their senior year in connection with the research that they were doing. This program started in 1969, and that first year, I think there were three students that received such grants. They were very minimal because the faculty committee, the faculty honors committee, decided not to use the original capital, but to use income only. So there wasn't a great deal of income. But these three students received funds. One was in English, one in chemistry, and one in history. The funds have accrued. Trewarthas, I think, altogether now have given something like $22,000. Other grants have been added, other gifts have been added to this fund, and with the income generated, the last indication was that the fund now included around $35,000 or $36,000. We're still using only the income for these grants. The grants are used during the school year. In other words, they're awarded in September, and the student has the funds then to use in the next year. We soon recognized the fact that there were some students that needed more funds and that they needed to have an opportunity to work full-time during the summer on their thesis the way a researcher normally does. Instead of having senior honors thesis along with four other courses during the school year, it was decided to try to develop a program that would enable a student to work full-time on his senior thesis during the summer between the junior and senior years. At the time, Professor Seymour Abramson of the Zoology Department was on the Faculty Honors Committee, and he suggested that we develop a proposal to present to the NAP Bequest Committee. Fortunately, his wife, Professor Shirley Abramson of the law school, was chairman of the committee at the time. So it was a very fortuitous alliance. The committee approved our request in 1972, and that first year gave us $2,000 to enable five students to work full-time for a 10-week period during the summer under their major professor. This amount was increased to $8,000 the next year, to $15,000 the third year, to $20,000 the fourth year, and was maintained at that rate until recently, when the NAP funds themselves dropped because of the stock market situation. For the current year, we're getting $12,000 from the NAP Bequest Committee, but we also get $10,000 from the Brittingham Fund through Chancellor Shane's help. And there's another grant, the Fraser Fund, that contributes about $1,800. So there's a fair amount of money that's available. Anywhere from 15 to 20 students get these grants for the summer between their junior and senior year. The theses that have been completed are really outstanding. Many of them have been published in professional journals. We've had no difficulty in getting some of the outstanding scholars in the university to serve as advisors for these senior honors theses. In fact, some of our top scientists, not only in letters and science, but also in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, and especially in the medical school, work with these senior students. There's no question but that the sciences have contributed the best research projects in this regard, especially the biological sciences, and especially the students that major in molecular biology.
That's interesting. Can you account for this in any way?
Well, I think that part of it is that the honors program attracts a lot of this biological science students, those going to medical school especially. And there's one program called the Biology Core Curriculum that begins in the freshman year. That's just an outstanding program. This is a program in biology that makes use of professors, again, from these same three colleges, from Letters and Science, from Ag, and from the medical school. And it's just a very good program. The students who complete the BioCore curriculum, when they take the medical college aptitude test, they just go through it in a whiz. It's a breeze for them. It's a very demanding program. It's a tough program, but it does attract very good students. Well, so that's the thing that I think I would brag about most is the money we were able to get to help students with their undergraduate research, and I would say that in my judgment, that's the highlight of the honors program.
Well, it sounds as though it's been very effective. Who, before we leave that area, who is on the Faculty Honors Committee? Where would the committee draw from?
Yes, the dean of the college appoints three members, and three members are elected by the LNS faculty. After the members have been, and they're elected for a three-year term, or appointed for a three-year term, after the elections have taken place, then the dean appoints somebody in an area that is not represented by the elected members, so that we try to have somebody from the humanities, somebody from the social studies, someone from biological sciences, someone from physical sciences on the committee. The director of the honors program serves as one member, so that I served as sort of the chairman of the program and of the committee during the time that I was active in the honors program. The present time, Dean F. Chandler Young is the chairman of the program. Now, there may be some change in the administration of the honors program because a committee was appointed by Dean Cronin to evaluate the program and to make recommendations. The recommendations have been made, but as yet no final action has been taken concerning it.
I see. So this is yet to, the outcome is not certain.
That's right, yeah.